So why is empathy so important for leadership?
Wait, what is empathy? This lady went up to a manager and said, my mother is very unwell, I need to leave. And the manager was heads down on the computer without thinking. He said, oh, you want to leave? Fine. Do you have a replacement? Perfectly fine statement. I mean, normally as a manager, that's what his normal reaction would. But this lady took a lot of offense because she said, you know what, my mother's unwell. You didn't ask about her. All you had to ask about whether I have a replacement. And even though she had worked for years in the organization, she finally left that company. So empathy is not about being strong. Empathy is also not about being weak. Empathy is basically, as the name suggests, is trying to put yourself in the other person's shoes. It's not what you say, it's how you say it. Sometimes is more important. Decision-making.
It's exciting to see how building the right relationship and understanding and listening and giving the safe space can change how people can perform. We have to give them an opportunity to express themselves.
Is that your top performers will never tell you what their problems are. It's the onus of the manager or the leader to find out what's going on with their lives.
Hello, Pathlock family and all the listeners tuning in. Welcome to Pathlock Lounge. I am Piyush Pandey, the CEO of Pathlock. Today we meet Suman Ghosh, an experienced leadership coach and author of the insightful book, Command to Empathy. Through his work, Suman dwells into the power of empathy in workforce, providing invaluable insights into fostering understanding and empathy in a professional work environment. So let's dive in and talk about the topic of importance of empathy in corporate structure. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Pathlock Lounge. Today's topic is very close to my heart. We're going to talk about empathy today, and I'm super excited about our guest, Suman Ghosh. Thanks for joining me today. And I'm very excited about this topic because this is the area of interest for me personally. And I want to learn more about how we can work better with people, how we can build better relationship with more empathy.
Okay.
So,
thanks
for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great. So, let me start with the first question I had. What got you interested in this topic, in this area, and what made you write a book about it?
So, I had already worked for over 20 years in different companies, different areas, mostly in IT. So very different from what I do today. But over time, I got interested in, I was always very observant of people. And as I grew in the organization, I realized finally it's all about people. So that's what my, and something happened. There was a trigger. I won't get into that. It's a story where, you know, somebody asked me, I was just doing a role play. And end of it, you know, I was convinced that I'd given a good answer. He said, but I don't think I'll go with that. And I said, why? In fact, I was so surprised. I said, was my logic incorrect? He said, your logic was spot on. I said, then what happened? He said, I didn't see much energy and emotion in you. Okay. I still remember coming back home that day and saying, what is this energy, emotion is he talking about? Because I used to take pride in the fact that, you know, my logic was always very good. So basically, it's that moving from the rational side to embracing the emotional side. So I got interested in it, did a lot of research, wrote a book on emotional intelligence. Yeah, so that's why I'm here, you know, talking about EQ. Oh,
that's great. That's very interesting. I've had a couple of situations in my personal life as well as in professional life where I understood the value of empathy and understanding where people come from is as important as the actual answer you give, right?
Yeah.
As you mentioned. So definitely, can we talk about why is empathy more relevant now as compared to what it used to be before?
So maybe let me start with, a little bit about how the world is changing very rapidly. So I like this framework of Gary Hamel. He talks of three types of economies.
Yep.
So he's saying everything started with the industrial economy, industrial revolution, and then the industrial economy. Then we had something called a knowledge economy. And then we are now moving into a creative economy. And the behaviors that are required for each one of them are very different. Okay, so it started with obedience, diligence, right? When you're, let's say you're an industrial kind of job, right? All is required. You come into work, you punch in your 9 hours and you're done. The work is cut out for you. You just do that. And then comes the knowledge economy where you also need to bring in intellect. Okay, you need to know your stuff. But the real change happens when you're in a creative economy. So suddenly, it's no longer about obedience, diligence, and intellect. Of course, those are still required. But what you need is initiative, creativity, and passion. And the problem is that you can't command these things. You know, I can command somebody to come on time. But if I say, hey, you know what, come Monday, I want to see more passion. Yeah, whatever little passion he or she had, that'll also go. Isn't it? So those are things which are very internal. You can't command them. So I think the real turning point is that today, whether we like it or not, we are in a creative economy. Okay. You might feel your job is more industrial, but end of the day, your organization is operating in a creative economy. And that's where, and if you have to bring in initiative, creativity, passion, those are all internal, all emotion driven. So that's why empathy becomes very critical.
No, that makes sense, because Pathlok as a company, we are a product company and we like to believe, and one of our core values, that we'll keep innovating our solution for our customers. And if our employees are not innovating whatever they offer, whether it's services or product or how we deliver our solutions to customers, then we're not going to improve. If you don't improve, then you become a dinosaur at some point. And
exactly. So innovation for you is very critical. I mean, we had this chat earlier as well. And you kept talking about innovation quite a few times. So I think for a company like yours, it's, you know, the people need to realize that we're in a creative economy. Innovation is what is critical, in which case everything needs to kind of, shift, starting with mindset. Need not be top down, but, you know, people need to bring in those skills, bring in those mindsets into the organization.
Yeah, definitely. So one of the topics which comes to what you wrote about in the book as well is why, if we have to talk about for normal people to listen, is why is empathy so important for leadership?
Okay.
And what is its relevance in companies like ours, which are growing, not very small company, but when you have 500,000, 5,000 people, why is empathy so important?
So I think, first of all, let's start by what is empathy? A lot of us, you know, people are often confused, you know, is it the same as sympathy? Mm-hmm. You know, what is empathy? When I do these workshops, especially with senior level people, I get a lot of pushback saying that, hey, you know what, I don't want to look weak. I don't want to sound weak. So that's why I don't want to be empathetic. So empathy is not about being strong. Empathy is also not about being weak. Empathy is basically, as the name suggests, is trying to put yourself in the other person's shoes, understanding, you know, where they're coming from, understanding their world. Not that I have to agree with them. Okay. I think that's what people are fearful of, but you don't have to agree with them. It's basically just understanding. And that's the starting point for people to connect. People feel good when they feel heard, when they feel connected. There's a sense of belonging. Today, that's what most organizations are trying to do. This entire DEI thing, it's about diversity, equity, inclusion. I think the next step is belonging. You know, diversity is more about numbers. You bring in somebody, maybe you met their targets, but do they really feel valued in the organization? Yeah. Do they feel belong? Do they belong? Let's say you're a minority group. Do you really belong to the organization? So for all of those things, empathy becomes very important. Also, since I started talking about EQ, there is a distinction. So empathy is only a part of emotional intelligence. So emotional intelligence, a very nice framework, a very simple one. It starts with self-awareness. I think everything starts with self-awareness. And once you're aware, you can kind of regulate yourself. So that's self-regulation. And then comes empathy, which is about putting ourselves in the other person's shoes. It's also important to understand that empathy is not about you know, shouting at somebody and then going and apologizing, say, you know what, it just happened. No, it doesn't work that way, right? Empathy is, you know, it. You need to bring in empathy with your customers, with your stakeholders. It manifests in terms of communication, how you communicate. It's not what you say, it's how you say it. Sometimes it's more important. Decision-making. So all those things, empathy becomes very important.
One of the instances I wanted to share, we experienced in our company, we have this policy when people don't perform, you put them in performance improvement plan to see if they can perform at the level they're required to. And there was this instance where one employee was not able to perform. We put them on, the manager put them on performance improvement plan, and without understanding why they were not performing. And then we found out there was a situation where there was a lot going on in their life. And when we spoke about it, understood and gave the opportunity, the same employee came back. They had a very difficult situation personally, and they came back and they performed very well. They went from the bottom performer to one of the top performers in the team. It's the same employee, same job.
Wow.
Understanding and building a relationship with the person, and they started performing. So they're still with us, and this particular employee is... it's exciting to see how building the right relationship and understanding and listening and giving the safe space can change how people can perform. And it is, for Pathlock, it's very important because we have offices and employees in 7 countries who come from different backgrounds. And if we want to innovate, we want to continue making progress, then we have to give them an opportunity to express themselves and innovate, right? So this was very important. So another topic I had was...
Can I just comment on that? I think it's a lovely story you shared. It's important for leaders to understand this, that often we think it's about the people, right? And we have this problem of labeling people. And once somebody's labeled, okay, this guy is a PIP kind of person, sometimes very difficult to kind of pull them out of that, right? I had a similar, I have a similar story with somebody, but in that case, the person performed very well, but when they changed the role. But this is very interesting that the same role the job person performed equally well, or even, you know, went from the bottom to the top. Just because you showed, you know, somebody showed interest, they feel valued. So I keep saying, you know, often we, this immense focus on people skills and people development, often it's got to do with the leadership, with the environment, with the culture of the organization. People per se are not good or bad. This is why I personally feel. It's basically, you know, what kind of environment they're operating in.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we definitely have to match their skills and what they want to do. But I personally been challenged with this situation because we have teams in Germany, teams in UK, Israel, in India. And people's working styles are different.
Yeah.
And another example we had where people are struggling in certain structures, although they've done very well historically. And eventually we changed their structure. They gave them a different environment. They started performing very well. Now, one of the questions which have been actually told to me as well is the point you mentioned that empathy was considered a weakness, right?
Yes.
But where is the boundary, right? You want to understand where people come from, right? What's going on in their life?
Yeah.
Is there a boundary where, you know, you're oversharing or you're trying to get too involved in their, say, personal life or what they want, what's going on in their in their head? Is there a line which you should not cross? Because when I think about it, is there a time where you can be more involved with your employees or people who report to you, right? And understanding, being more empathetic can mean that you're actually being part of their life, right?
Yeah. So that's a great question. I feel that it would have been good if people were so involved that you're thinking whether you're crossing the line. Often it's the other way around. We know very little about people. And especially when a company is growing, You know, when you're 5, 10 people, 20 people, you kind of know everybody. But the moment the company starts growing, it's very difficult to get to know people, isn't it? I personally had that experience many years back. So we were going live on a project and one of my team members, let's call him Balaji. So Balaji was a great guy and he was always there, you know, very good contributor. So we had a meeting the following day and it was an important meeting where we had to present to the leadership. And the meeting was at 9 a.m. and I told Balaji, hey, we have this meeting. Make sure you come. He said, okay. And then we went off. Next morning, I was there in the office, but Balaji was nowhere to be seen. So I was wondering what happened. And, you know, I was a bit irritated, but I didn't say anything. And met with somebody else. And I was generally talking about this. He said, oh, I don't think Balaji would make it for a 9 o'clock. This person told me. I said, why? He said, do you even know where he stays? I said, no. So it seems he had a 2-hour commute and he was on the night shift the day before. Okay. He would have probably reached home only at whatever, you know, after midnight. So there was very difficult for him to come the next morning. It was kind of an aha moment for me because when I reflected on it, one is I learned that this happened because I knew very little of Balaji as a person. I knew him as a resource. I didn't know him as a person. But I think there was a bigger lesson in there is that your top performers will never tell you what their problems are. It's the onus of the manager or the leader to find out what's going on with their lives. Okay? And I think that's why empathy becomes very important. You might feel everything is fine, but maybe everything is not fine, but they're not telling you. So I think it's our responsibility to go and figure out. So yeah, but again, if you want to get in and you're not, the idea is not to probe. You can ask for permission. Hey, looks like you're, you know, something's bothering you. You want to talk about it? I'm there to talk. And if you're okay with that. So there are communication mechanisms to do that. But people always feel good when, you know, you're trying to understand them as a person, not just as a resource.
So this is something which I have experienced personally some time back. If we encourage people to share more, right? And suppose I go and ask people and they let me know. How do we make sure that people feel safe sharing wherever they are?
Yeah.
And maybe if I go and ask somebody, they share something with me and I'm a safe person, they feel safe sharing that information with
me.
But what about the rest of the people, right? Yeah. What if rest of the team start judging, okay, oh, you have this problem going on. Obviously, you cannot perform at the level and I might not give you that specific project or responsibility or that role.
Yeah.
Right. So how do we think about creating that safe environment, not just from the manager, but all the people around, right?
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a big challenge. See, if you're leading the company, you have a certain style. Maybe the people reporting to you also kind of, you know, follow a similar style. But the moment you have different layers, how do you know what's happening below?
Yeah.
Right? But whose responsibility is it? And I keep saying, finally, everything
buck stops
with the top, right? How much time are people investing to find out what's the pulse of the organization? How much time is a leader spending to see not just his direct reports, but what are the people below doing? And there could be many different mechanisms. If it's a very large company, maybe you send out surveys. Maybe you make them anonymous. But there has to be a way to figure out the pulse of the organization. And also not to take people for granted, right? Also to understand who your top performers are. It's again a typical Pareto, right? 80-20. 20% of the people typically does 80% of the work. Okay. Are we doing anything different for those 20% people? So that, because if they quit, that's too late. It's too late in the game, right? And they don't suddenly quit. That something would have been going on for the last 6 months, which their manager is not able to pick up. And that shows a lack of empathy. And again, there are many nuances. It's about cognitive empathy, which is thinking what you're thinking. And there is affective empathy, which is feeling what you're feeling. So a person who is good at that, they can do that. In corporate environments, it's more cognitive. I'm sure you'll recognize, like we had managers in our, you know, as we were growing in the organization, you'd walk into their cabin and one look at you and they'd say, I know what you're thinking. Yeah, there are managers like that. Very high cognitive empathy. They just know exactly what's on people's minds. Yeah, so basically, but that's something we, you know, people need to keep working on. At least the focus should be on the other person. But again, it's not easy. It's incredibly hard, especially when, you know, we all live in our heads and we have so many things in our head. How do you, I keep saying this, you know, it's like getting into another person's shoes, but first you have to take off your shoes.
You have to be ready for that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that brings another question, which is a topic which I've heard a lot. Can we teach empathy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's a lovely story. So there's this guy sitting on a park bench. And there was a runner who kept passing by. And while he was running, he asked this guy, what's the time? He looked at his watch and he told him the time. And this guy went off. And coincidentally, within about 30 seconds, another runner came and asked this guy, what's the time? And this guy pulled out his watch. He looked at it for some time and told him the time. So after this guy went, there was a guy sitting next to him. He said, hey, I just observed what happened. I'm very curious. You knew the time. Why did you have to look at your watch? And he said, yeah, I knew the time, but the person who asked me didn't know that I knew the time. So if I had told him the time, if I just told him without looking at my watch, you wouldn't have believed me. Okay. I love that. I think it's a very powerful metaphor for empathy because this guy is constantly processing information from how the other guy is perceiving it or how the other guy is looking at it, not from his point of view, but the other person's point of view. And I think that's a skill that we need to build, constantly to ask ourselves, what is the other guy, thinking about it? What is the other guy feeling? Is he feeling nervous? You know, the other day I was one of the people in that training thing, she told me, you know what, I went for this interview and I really love this company. I said, why, what happened? They said, you know, I went in, but they made me comfortable for the last first half an hour. They realized I was a bit nervous. So they made me sit down, they made me comfortable, right? So obviously the person on the other side had that empathy to realize that, you know, she needed to be first made comfortable, okay? So it's about how you're feeling, how you're thinking. Like that example of the park bench, yeah. Constantly processing information from the other person's point of view is a muscle that we need to build. And the moment we ask that, I think, we kind of build empathy. Again, I always also say that it's not about building it from scratch. We are born with empathy. So there's a lot of research done. Empathy actually, in the neurologically speaking, comes from mirror neurons. So in fact, if you put a baby next to another crying baby, the other baby also starts crying. Okay? Even before they've learned language, because their mirror neurons are at work. Okay? So that's empathy in action. So this baby is mirroring the other baby's emotion. Okay? So we are born with empathy. It's been proven. It's just that as we grow up, we lose empathy. So the question is really, can we get that back? Yeah, so yeah, I think just with any other thing, you know, we need to constantly be reminded of that mindset and thinking from the other person's point of view. That could be a great starting point.
Yeah, that'll be great. Do you have any thoughts on how this can be done? Is it a conversation within the company or we should have HR trainings on?
I think some amount of training does help. So I want to take two scenarios. One is when you're calm. Because when you're stressed, you know, it's a completely different ballgame, okay? But when you're calm, how do you make out, again, it's about self-awareness, right? So let me take some examples. So maybe I'll narrate a story. This lady got a call saying her mother was very unwell. And she went up to a manager and said, my mother is very unwell, I need to leave. And the manager was heads down on the computer and without thinking, he said, oh, you want to leave? Fine. Do you have a replacement? Okay. Perfectly fine statement. I mean, normally as a manager, that's what his normal reaction would be. But this lady took a lot of offense because she said, you know what? My mother's unwell. You didn't ask about her. All you had to ask about whether I have a replacement. Okay. And this is a real story. And even though she had worked for years in the organization, finally things went from that, you know, the fracture that happened never got mended. You know, she finally left that company. Question is about awareness. Are we, and this happens because of what is called, we often run on autopilot. Because we're not thinking. There's so much stuff happening at us. We're not thinking, we're just responding. Okay. We're not even responding, we're reacting.
Yeah.
Okay. But it can do tremendous amount of damage without us realizing it. Okay. So it requires a lot of self-awareness to calibrate your response given the situation. To take a pause before responding. Okay. So first is to come out of autopilot. And this is even when we are not stressed. This is not a stressful environment, right? When we are stressed, it's a different ballgame. Yeah. You talked of safety. So what happens is, let's say I'm very stressed and something happens and I lose it and I suddenly lash out at someone. What I don't realize is the kind of damage it's caused because I've just created fear in the organization.
Yep.
Yeah. People would, you talked of safety a little earlier. You've just created conditions of not being a safe place. And because it's a fear, it doesn't go away. It may have happened 1 year back, but people still have that fear that, oh, this guy's volatile. Let me not say something. It's not safe to say something because this guy might lash out. So leadership, again, you know, I think we talked of training. I think the first thing we need to, make leaders, especially senior leaders, understand is the kind of responsibility that they have. We often tend to forget that a lot of the things, we're talking of culture and all that, a lot of the things are based on the leader's behavior and actions. Not even so much as to what they're saying. You know, to that extent, it's a bit like parenting. You know, the kids don't listen to what their parents say. Yeah. They do what the parents are doing because they observe. And they're exactly the same in organizations, which again puts a lot of onus on people to kind of manage their emotions. Isn't it? I'm sure if I ask you or ask anybody that, have you done something, in a moment of whatever anger that you regretted later? And sure. I think most of us would say yes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But is it difficult to change? Absolutely, extremely difficult. So I think it's more like a lifelong journey. But yeah, it's possible. It all starts with awareness.
Yeah, I think I really like that idea because when I think about there's so many stressful situations in work life and personal life, especially the example you gave about the manager was thinking about the deadlines because you at work, you're stressed and you're only thinking about singular focus. My focus is, how will I get this stuff done?
Yes. Right?
And so your mind is so preoccupied
with
that goal or the stress, which is stress of not reaching there or whatever the pressure might be, that you're not open for any more ideas. So you're not open for what's happening in front of you right now. You're not present, right? I clearly understand because I've been a culprit of this situation where there's something in your mind already and you are not even reacting. You are just going on with what was going on and you took this situation, put it on the side and you still keep doing it.
Yeah.
So I clearly understand. I will definitely keep that in mind moving forward because I think it'll change how you react or respond to a situation at that moment versus if 2 days later, if you think about what should I have done, but you don't have the space to do it because your mind is preoccupied completely, right? So I'm thinking out loud at this point, right, that for people or managers or leadership to be empathetic, they need to have space where they are comfortable with the targets, goals, and the stress they have. Because there's no space for listening to people and then we can't make rest of the team safer.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if they're reflecting 2 days later, it's a good start. At least you're reflecting. Because it all starts with reflection. Okay, what am I doing wrong or what could I change? The other thing which also needs to happen is feedback.
Yep.
Reflection is one thing, but I also need to check with people. Hey, how am I doing? Is there anything that I could have done differently? But all that requires a certain level of vulnerability, certain level of courage, certain level of confidence for a leader to do that. Okay. I really like this thing about, you said, being present. You know, they're not present. You're absolutely right. I think that's absolutely critical. Just to be present. I think as a leader, to be present is the most important thing. We need to train ourselves to do that. So again, since we're talking of, you know, what kind of capacity building we can do, maybe a bit of mindfulness training would help. And there's a lot of focus on that. And there are a lot of definitions of mindfulness. The one which I really like is when you're saying and doing, you know, when you're doing something and thinking of the same thing, you're being mindful. If those two are not in sync, then you're not mindful. Okay. So I come into work in the morning, I have a meeting, but I'm thinking of the afternoon meeting. In the afternoon meeting, I'm thinking about the dinner I have with my wife. But when I'm having the dinner, I'm thinking about the next day's board meeting. So essentially, that's being mindless, because you're not focusing on the present. Okay. If you're able to do that, being mindful, if this leader was mindful that, yes, somebody has come and asking for help, and let me get out of my autopilot, let me be present and respond, I think that situation could have been averted. Maybe another story, if you have the time. So
yeah, definitely.
One of my coaching clients, he works for a company in India, in Bangalore. Young chap, but doing very well. He's like the blue-eyed boy of the company. His supplier, they supply to all these big aviation guys in the US. Big guys, okay? The Boeings, Airbuses, whatever. So he was going for one of the meetings to the US to attend a very important meeting with one of these customers of his. So he was telling me the story. He said, "Someone, you know what? It took me 6 months to get into that meeting." I said, "Why?" He said, "Being a defense company, you know, because we are in defense, and you know, they had to run a whole lot of background checks, and that took a lot of time." But he said, "You know what? Finally, when I was in the meeting, I was amazed." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Imagine this Fortune 10 or 20 company with their CXO sitting there. You can't get busy, more busy than them." They said there were no distractions. They had nothing with them. They just came and sat. And even when I was talking, and I'm just one small guy, some supplier from India, he said they were intently listening to what I was saying. And they were responding. They were present. And he felt so bad, good about it. He came and narrated the story to me. So as a leader, when people feel their leaders are present, it's a great feeling. That's what motivates people.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things which I was talking to somebody last week about this is, one is you spoke about being safe, right? People come to you when they feel safe that they'll be heard and they'll not be judged, or they will not be ridiculed, or whatever that might be. The situation might be. The other part is, are you approachable?
Yeah.
I got this feedback last month, and I was telling somebody that, okay, when this situation happened, why didn't you come to me?
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
And like, why am I hearing about it now, not before? And one person said that, you know, people, it depends on the person. If they don't think you're approachable, then they might not reach out to you. They might reach out to somebody else, right? So I think this might go into the same thing. If they feel safe reaching out to you, especially when situations have gone wrong, then are people feeling safe enough to approach you rather than building the castle that how do I defend myself when the blaming is going to come on me?
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So I think it slightly goes on a different topic, but it's about giving the safe space to the employee that, you know, if something has gone wrong, and what is more important is we figure out what went wrong and how do we fix it and it doesn't happen again, rather than, oh, am I going to get the blame? Right. And I don't know how it fits into this, but it impacts the decision-making process for employees and for managers on how they act on it, right?
Yeah.
So that brings another question, right? How does empathy go with the decision-making ability, right? If you are more empathetic, does it reduce your ability to make faster decisions or...
So maybe I'll just come to decision-making, but before that, I just want to respond to the other point about being approachable. And you're saying whether it fits. I think it fits perfectly. It's very important to be approachable.
Yep.
But at the same time, the higher up you are, automatically you're less approachable.
Yeah.
So when I say this, a lot of leaders say, you know what, but I have an open door policy. My door is open. I said, maybe the right metric is not whether your door is open, it's how many people are walking in that door.
Yes, that's
right.
True. Yeah,
that shows you how approachable you are, isn't it? There's also a cultural element. Okay, because if somebody like three levels below want to approach you and you're a highly approachable guy, the problem is his lead manager may not like that.
Yeah.
Okay, and that there is a cultural angle to that as well. So all those have to be managed. Anyway, these things are difficult. And I think since you work across different countries, it just compounds the problem, amplifies the problem, because there are cultural nuances also. Okay, like I just talked of, you know, this one is about power distance. India is a very high power distance country. Okay. So that's about it. And then coming to decision-making, again, decision-making, I think, is very critical, as much, if not more, than communication. And half the conflict happens because of decision-making. Okay. While not taking a decision is a problem,
yeah.
But the question is, how you decide and who decides is very important. So if you look at the decision-making styles, you have the, and if you think about it as a spectrum, right, where you're very authoritative on one side and very autocratic on one side and democratic on one side. Decision-making could be authoritative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I decide and that happens. Okay. It could be, on the other extreme, could be consensus-based. Everybody decides. Like you mentioned about working in teams.
Yep.
Teams need to build consensus, isn't it? Otherwise, not a team, it's a group. Okay. And of course, there's something in the middle which is consultative. Is there anything right or wrong in terms of style? No, it depends on the situation. Consensus is good in terms of buying in, getting more buy-in from people, but it takes an enormous amount of time. And sometimes we don't have that time. So we are more consultative or authoritative. Right? Now, a lot of these things are perception-based. I might think I'm very authoritative. Yeah. I might think I'm very consultative, but the other person thinks I'm authoritative. Yeah. We talked with another example about micromanaging. I might think, you know, I'm just doing my job, but you might think I'm micromanaging it. It is a lot of it's a perception. Now, perception, how do I get? That requires self-awareness. Because self-awareness is not only about knowing what I am doing, it's also about perceiving how the other guy is looking at you. Okay? So I think that awareness also needs to get built. Make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's it's very... it's an area where people can, we can take things differently. So I'll give you an example of where I struggled personally. When 3-4 years back, we were around 100 people. We were a very flat organization. In fact, we didn't even have managers as such. Everybody used to do something. And I personally had, and I have a number of colleagues in the office, they can attest for it. We were an open door policy. Anybody can reach out to me, and people used to reach out to me. This goes back to your question very, yeah. very well. People yeah. used to reach out to me all the time
yeah.
from different departments, and none of the managers used to mind.
Okay.
Right. Now,
so that became the culture.
That became the culture.
Yeah.
And I think people weren't worried. I mean, sometimes managers say it'll be good if I knew about something before the CEO finds out. But now we've gone from 100 people to more than 500 people in 7 countries. And I never thought about it before you said it. I still have the same policy that people can reach out to me. People do reach out to me. Some people do.
Yeah.
But when I think about it, only people who have worked with me before, they reach out to me. Very few people who have come from different organizations or they've never interacted with me have reached out to me,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So although I built a policy, it's probably not as prevalent in the organization. They don't reach out to us probably because they don't feel I'm approachable or the situation where what will the manager think, right? But I certainly believe that for me to be approachable has to be part of the company's culture.
Yeah.
And managers, middle-level managers have to live with the concept that everything is open. You don't have to be defensive.
Yeah.
So if you go around somebody, there's a reason for it. don't worry about it. Just solve the problem and not try to defend what you're trying to do. But that brings another point is, how do you build an organization where decision making, if you have a hierarchical organization and as a manager, as a leader, you're supposed to decide stuff, right? I've seen situations where people who are very decisive, people like that in the organization, outside the organization. And in certain cultures, if you're consultative or you're just facilitating the decision, that's fine, right? I guess both answers can be right or wrong depending on who's looking at it.
Yeah.
So that's something, when I think about it, one question can be, is the right answer more important or just coming to an answer which the team can agree and move forward with? That is more important, right?
Great question. So the leader has to first figure out where on that spectrum they should be for that particular situation. If it's something that requires a lot of buy-in, he or she should kind of avoid this tendency to push through their ideas. Give space to the team to build their, because consensus is important. Okay. And sometimes it's a lack of awareness. I'll tell you a small example. Let's say you're in a meeting and you have to decide on something by the end of the meeting. Mindset is consultative. Hey guys, what do you think? Okay, now 5 minutes left for the meeting. Okay, guys, let's just do this.
Yeah.
So what, without realizing, you have gone from a consultative to a completely authoritative style. If that is situation was important, then you wouldn't close it in those last 5 minutes. You'll say, hey guys, let's reconvene and do this again. Yeah. So starts with the awareness in terms of where you want to be in terms of what style you want to this thing. If you have to avoid conflict, also be very transparent about the style beforehand. I was talking of perception. A lot of the perception can be solved by saying, hey guys, let's decide how we decide before the decision. Okay. You know what? I'm going to give you 2 weeks to decide on this. If at the end of it, you're not able to do it, I'll come in and hear you out, but I'm going to take a decision. Classic consultative style. But after 2 weeks, when you do that, people don't think you're authoritative because you had your 2 weeks. Okay. Within those 2 weeks, ask yourself, do you want to be in that meeting? That's again a very interesting question. Sometimes as leaders, we feel, oh, we are only adding value. Yeah. So Marshall Goldsmith in that classic book of his, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, he has this nice line and it says, as you grow more senior, your suggestions become orders.
Become modest.
Become orders.
Orders, yeah.
Without you realizing, you think you're suggesting, but the others perceive it as an order. Let's say I'm the leader in the room and everybody's throwing ideas and say, hey guys, what do you think of this idea? In my mind, it's just another idea. To others, it's not another idea. It is the idea.
Yeah.
Because it's come from the boss.
And now they can't question it.
They can't question it. Why question it? The boss has said it. Let's just do it. So again, without realizing, you've become authoritative. Okay. So if you have to really build a culture of inclusion, it puts a tremendous amount of onus in terms of deciding how to decide, the leader deciding what kind of decision-making style they should be using. Deciding whether they should be in that. Okay. And sometimes, you know, it also, that risk is also there. If you're letting the team decide, it shouldn't happen. They spend 2 weeks and they come to you and they say, no, let's not do this. Let's do this. Because thereafter, they're not going to decide anything on their own. So does that mean I'm willing to accept something which may be differing from my own point of view, what the team has brought? That's the trust that I have on the team. Jeff Bezos talks about it a lot. He says, sometimes I agree to disagree. Yeah, I say, fine. You guys are smart guys. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you're right. Go ahead and do it. Even though I do not agree, I agree with their approach, with their strategy. And that takes a lot of confidence to be able to trust the team so much.
Yeah. So that brings another question, because I remember watching this video of Steve Jobs where he mentioned that great companies always innovate, right? It doesn't matter what you produce, whether it's process or product. And one of the things he said, that you hire really smart people. You want to hire people who know more about a specific department or an area more than you. And when you hire them, you have to give them space to make the decision. If you tell them what to do, then what's the point in hiring them, right? Now, the other topic he mentioned in that video was, you hire somebody for their skill set, their knowledge, or what they've done, and they're about to make a decision, and you might think that it might be a wrong decision, they're going to fail, right? Do you go and change it,
mm-hmm.
or you let them fail and let them figure it out?
Mm. Good question. Yeah. So this is exactly opposite of what, by the way, it was called, I think the value is called disagree and commit.
Disagree and commit,
yeah. It's part of their, set of values. But here you're saying, I think the leader has to take a call if it's something that is so important. But even if the person feels, it's perception. See, the point is that I'm the leader. I feel that this team is wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. In there lies an assumption that I am more correct than they are.
Yep.
Now, where is that coming from? In an industrial economy, absolutely. As you grew higher, you knew more about the business. In a creative economy, that's often not the case. You often have people reporting to you who know much more than you in their subject matter. So how can you just being the leader, say that, hey, let's go with this, because then you're saying that I'm right.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Which may not be the case.
Yeah.
So in a creative economy, I don't think we should be pushing so hard, because let's understand that the knowledge maybe lies much more outside you, and people don't expect the leader to have all the answers also in a creative economy.
So this goes back to the concept which you mentioned in your book, right? Do you, leader's role is to command, or so I guess how do you work with people in different industries,
mm-hmm.
on how leaders should perform? They should lead by commanding, or where is the fine line? Where do you decide whether you're commanding or you are on a consensus basis?
So the book is called Command to Empathy.
Yeah.
Most leadership styles are command and control, because that's we got that from our industrial economy. Okay. As I was telling about the three types of economies, that works perfectly well in an industrial setup. People also expect the leader to have the answers and tell the people, and you just do it. It's directive.
Yeah.
Top down, you don't need any empathy, you don't need any EQ, and it was fine. Now we are in a different stage where we are in the creative economy, where that thing is not working. Our research told us that most companies realize today that command and control is not the best way to run an organization today. It's very obvious. You ask a fresher, you give him or her command, what happens? The next day, the guy quits, isn't it? So attrition, that's why is so high in so many organizations. But I think a lot of companies are still grappling with, if it's not command, then what is it? And that's where we are arguing in the book, it's more empathy. And empathy is more of a mindset. Command is more of a style. So, and it requires all those changes that I talked about. You know, be aware, be present, come out of autopilot, see what they want, include, ask for ideas, ask. And of course, start with why. I think the most powerful question, I think that was the name of the book, right? Simon Sinek wrote that book, Start With Why. Start With Why. And I think as a communication thing, why is, again, extremely powerful. Instead of telling what the answer is, ask, what would you do? Do you have a role model? What do you think he or she would do? So that's the coaching style, and that needs to evolve in the organization. That's the only way you're going to start getting ideas, create safety, then ideas start bubbling up, and then you have a much more inclusive organization.
Yeah. So another thought which came to my mind, which is driven from the concept of command, or leaders drive everything in the company or even outside, is what about goals, what we want to accomplish in smaller tasks? And one of the things which I've never struggled with, because I was a driven person and always knew where we want to go. But I think your argument makes me question the basic concept that if somebody asks me, where will Pathlock be 3 years from now? I have an answer ready. It's crystal clear in my mind, right? But that begs the question, is that the right goal for Pathlock to be 3 or 5 years from now? Or is it open for discussion for people who are contributing to Pathlock to provide an input into what Pathlock should be 3 years from now? As a company, as a growth, as its culture should be driven completely by the people at the top, or there is space for people to influence the culture, the goals, and where the journey of the company is going in changing the gene or the part of the company. And ultimately, that decides what company becomes 3 or 5 years from now.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And there's no easy answer. Traditionally, the leader had to set the goal, and they were only looking at how to percolate that information down. But now I think your question is more about put people buy into that, right? Does that call for a discussion? I mean, if you think about the context of decision-making, it's very interesting. So let's say you decided what the goals are, okay? So imagine even your immediate staff takes it as it's an authoritative style of decision-making that you've done. But let's say that you didn't do that. You actually consulted with your staff, okay? And it was a real consensus. You spent a lot of time to decide on the goals and everybody was happy. In your mind and in your staff's mind, you are consensus-based.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens to the guy below that, one level below? In his mind, what style have you used? Authoritative, because he's not been consulted. Okay. So perception-wise, it'll always be authoritative because they had no role to play in that decision. But having said that, how much deeper can you go? That's a call that you have to take.
Yep.
Do I include one person, 5 people, or 30 people, or 50 people? That's a call that you have to take. Okay. But if you want more inclusion, we'll need to bring in that that conversation, right? Even if it's kind of decided, you can always get feedback so that people feel that they had a say in this thing. To question, hey, why this number? Why not this number? How about we do this? You're getting ideas. Okay. Hey, you know what? We tried this last year and this is the mistake that we did. Why don't we learn from that? So maybe we'll get some good ideas. But I think inclusion is very important, isn't it? Especially in this new generation.
Yeah.
Right. I think we were talking briefly about that. People want to know why. People want to feel heard. People want to feel that they have contributed. And that's where I think the empathy becomes very important.
Yeah, no, I think that's very, very true. And I was reading this article about people have to feel they belong. And they work in companies where they want to associate themselves or their identities with those companies. And they perform better when they feel they belong to the culture, the name, the brand of the company, right? But that brings another point, which is a very current issue, is how do you, what role does empathy play in managing people who are in their 40s or 50s or slightly older versus millennials who are, they require a different level of management or management style, right? What role does empathy play in managing people of different ages and different backgrounds, right?
Empathy plays a big role in bridging the gap. I think there's a big gap right now. In every organization, especially large organizations where you have middle managers who could be in their 40s, late 40s, right? There is a tremendous gap because there is a bit of suspicion about the other group, right? The senior people feel that, oh, these youngsters, they don't want to work.
Yeah.
They're always trying to look for a way out. And there's been a lot of research on that. In fact, one of the chapters we dedicated on millennials in the book. Long story short, what they found is the millennials are no different than any generation before that. So there's always been this thing of generation gap.
Yep.
Right? So we never agreed with our parents because we thought they were from a
different generation,
outdated generation. We thought we were modern, and our kids now think the same about us. So there will always be a generation gap. The gap today is no different. I think it requires empathy for leaders, for senior people to understand that they've been brought up in a very different world. Yeah. For them, let's take some simple examples. This entire working from home. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have been brought up in a time where work was a place. Today, for the young generation, work is not a place. Work could be any place, anytime, anywhere. Okay. And that's how they operate. Even when they're studying, you know, it can be any time. I didn't know what time my kid studied. Maybe he was up whole night and he was doing something. And he'll have weird hours, right? And it's not that he's sitting at home and doing it. Maybe he's going somewhere and doing it. So to them, that's what they've been brought up with. To them also, they don't see work as a place. Now, are we giving them the flexibility? Okay. And that requires empathy. And I see this struggle all the time, especially after COVID. Senior leaders, in fact, with large companies, the leaders have said, okay, now the people need to come back.
Yeah.
So when I ask the guys, you know, the middle managers, hey, how are you handling it? Are people actually back? They say, no, actually our people are not back. So why are you not getting them back? No, if I push too hard, they'll quit. So what are you doing? No, I'm just trying to balance it out. Okay. So there's a clear disconnect. The problem is that the decision has been taken without empathy, okay, that this needs to be done. Now, whether it meets the need or at least it calls for a discussion.
Yep.
Okay. And I think, and I see so many instances of this where decisions are kind of taken at the top and trying to be pushed down. At least it calls for a conversation.
I think that's what empathy will mean, because I was thinking about a discussion I was having with a friend of mine. She works in Wall Street in New York. And she was very excited that Jamie Dimon and most of the Wall Street have said, okay, everybody back to office. And you're like, oh, all this drama of people working from home doesn't work. And the way I think about what you're saying is, if I try to think in my head, is that empathy is about conversation with people, with whatever conversation they want to have. Some people might say, I need the flexibility. And some people want to go to the place where they used to work and they can focus. So it's about having conversation, giving people the flexibility of whatever work means to them so that they are more fulfilled. And it can be different for a millennial versus somebody who has a different working style, right? I guess we need to do a better job of that.
I think we need to change our mindset that we are no longer in an industrial economy.
Yeah.
In an industrial economy, a great engineer is 2x of a good engineer.
Yeah.
But a great coder is 100x of a good coder.
Yeah.
That's the creativity. Question is, do you recognize that people are not dispensable? We grew up with this idea that people are dispensable.
Yeah.
Hello, but in a creative economy, people are not dispensable. One or two guys can make or break the company. They can be so good. What are you doing differently to empathize and make sure that they remain with the company? Requires a different mindset.
That's a very insightful thought. I think, if I think about it, that's very, very true. There are a handful of people who make a disproportionate amount of contribution to the company. So managers have to be very, very empathetic to how to give them the space to create that value for the company, right? So do we do anything differently when we hire people who are coming out of college? Does that mean that we have a process which is working, but you hire, we had a batch of 27 people last year from campus. Do we do something completely different for them? Or?
Not really. I think staying connected is important. They should know that there's a manager they can look up to, they can, you know, who is approachable, who's talking to them, explain why. You know, this new generation wants to know why. That purpose has suddenly become very important. You know, we were even talking of kids, right? Yeah. I never challenged anybody, questioned somebody. My son, you know, I was trying to teach something to my son. First thing he said, why am I studying this? How do you answer a kid as to why he's studying a differential calculus? Okay. But it's a very powerful question. The why, that goes straight to purpose. People are asking, why am I doing this in the organization? Okay. And to answer that, it requires a certain level of clarity in the leader's mind to be able to answer that. Okay, so we need to be clear as to why they're doing what they're doing. And I think it goes to, you know, leadership is hard, but leadership is also very simple if you think about it at another level. End of the day, people just want to feel valued and they want their work to be valued. So for a leader, one is, are you aware, for instance, are you aware of your biases? You know, sometimes we have empathy, but what I call selective empathy. You're empathetic to your top performers, but this, you show no empathy to your bottom performers because I've labeled them, isn't it? But you're doing great in the injustice. And this top performer is saying, hey, I'm the one who's loaded. Everything comes, it comes on my plate. And these other guys are just chilling out.
Freeloading, yeah.
Yeah, freeloading, exactly. Empathy can't be selective. And if the person you still feel is not, you know, matching up to your needs, it requires a conversation, sometimes a difficult conversation. There are techniques of how you do a difficult conversation. And if you do that right, people do turn around. Like your example of people moving from the bottom to the top in a PIP. It's possible, but I think it requires that those conversations.
That's definitely very insightful. I think that's something we will probably discuss in our management meeting and probably have more training for the team so that we can march towards that direction. But one of the questions I had is that if you can read something from your book,
okay,
which will be helpful to our audience and on the topics we discussed today, that'll be great if you can do that.
So let me read out a little bit about I was talking of a bit of the neuroscience before this. So, okay, I'm just reading bits and pieces. So I talked about a situation where somebody got, triggered and they behaved in a certain irrational way. So there's this concept of emotional contagion. Emotions are contagious. Like diseases are contagious. You get it, from the other person. So neurologically speaking, this emotional contagion is explained by means of the mirror neuron system, okay, which we shall discuss in detail later in the chapter. Emotional contagion has huge implications in the world of business. We often come across managers who complain that their teams have all the resources, tools, and database, but appear to lack energy. What they fail to realize is that the team's energy is a direct reflection of the manager's energy, thanks to emotional contagion. When a leader is calm, happy, and energized, those qualities get reflected in the way his organization or team behaves and performs. You may have observed in your workplace, a leader walks into a meeting looking down and tense. And even before he says a word, his body language itself is enough to suck the life out of the room. Okay. Such is the power of emotional contagion. Leaders, by the very dint of their position, exert a disproportionate impact on the moods and feelings of their team members. Studies have shown that emotional contagion plays a significant role in work group dynamics. People do not live on emotional islands, and team members vicariously experience moods at work, wherein these moods ripple out to affect not only other team members' emotions, but also to influence their group dynamics and individual contagion cognitions, as well as attitudes and behaviors. Thus, everyone's, but especially the leaders' emotions and behaviors can lead to tangible ripple effects in their teams and organizations.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful concept. And I'm just thinking about it. That means that everybody can make a contribution, especially leaders can, in having that impact on the broader organization.
And I think they need to recognize that.
Yeah.
Leaders don't realize that they have a disproportionate impact on the organization, even on safety.
Yeah.
Like, remember we talked of safety. When the leader is not approachable or not safe, that culture percolates. In fact, I read somewhere, there's so much talk on psychological safety that they're saying today's leaders, their number one job of leaders today is to create an environment of safety. That is going to start this entire cycle of inclusion and innovation and productivity, right? And the bottom-up approach. Because till that is met, nothing's going to change.
Yeah, that's definitely helpful. I think if you think about it, innovation will drive from a place of safety where people can think clearly,
yeah.
They can align. And if we can bring alignment and safety together, then we can give our millennials or people who have been in industry for 25 years the space to express themselves and take us to the goals, which might be the right goals for the company, I guess.
But they might make mistakes also.
We have to have a space for that.
Yes, there is a space for that. Exactly. You need that culture.
So I think that was a great discussion, Simon. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I would like you to finish with any thoughts you might have to finish this conversation for our audience. If you have anything you would like to finish thought, we'll go with that.
Maybe I'll end with a quote. So Stalin once said, the death of one man is a tragedy. The death of millions is a statistic. And as leaders, let's not convert everything into a statistic, into a metric. Every person is important. And if you start looking at it like that, from that lens, I think that's the start of empathy and any change in our organization.
That can be very powerful. Thank you, Simon. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.